The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to recap the 100 and Change competition. The MacArthur Foundation awarded the $100 million prize a month or two ago, and we'll have the winner here with us this evening, along with one of the other finalists. And you will also hear from the woman who oversaw the entire competition. She is Cecilia Conrad, the managing director of the MacArthur Foundation.
We issued an open call to the world and asked, tell us what $100 million might do. We opened that call in June of 2016. The submissions came in September, October of 2016. And then just recently, we announced the recipient of the $100 million grant.
Now, if you want to see a young person's eyeballs roll, just mention to them civics class. But there's a new organization that is empowering young people to become engaged and effective citizens, teaching civics in a whole new way. It's called Generation Citizen, and you will hear from its co-founder and CEO, Scott Warren.
What we fundamentally believe is that our democracy will be stronger if we have more people participate in it. And in order to ensure that we have a strengthened democracy with more robust participation, we need to ensure that we're teaching young people before they actually turn voting age.
And for our Better Than Most Corporate Culture segment, we will be visiting the offices of Teach for America. But as we always do, we'll start with the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. The Andrew W. Mellon Foundation has announced the appointment of writer, poet, scholar, and arts advocate Elizabeth Alexander as its new president, effective in March. Perhaps most widely known for her poem, Praise Song for the Day, which she recited at the 2009 inauguration of former President Barack Obama, Alexander was most recently the director of creativity and free expression at the Ford Foundation. A new study finds that even just seeing a tree or hearing a bird song will improve your state of mind. And the effect doesn't disappear once you get back to the office. It can last for several hours, with especially strong results for people who suffer from mental disorders. Most donors believe that the typical nonprofit organization spends too much on overhead, administration, and fundraising, but they often have no idea what their own favorite charity spends, a study from Gray Matter Research and Opinions for Good finds. According to a poll conducted by Weber Shandwick, around 83% of people said it's more important than ever for consumers to show support for companies by buying from them. It appears that boycotts are slowly overtaking boycotts as the preferred means of activism. And finally, the site that lets people help teachers fund their classrooms just hit a big milestone. Donors Choose has funded its 1 millionth project. Our congratulations to founder and CEO Charles Best and the entire Donors Choose team. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Cecilia Conrad of the MacArthur Foundation right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
There were over 7,000 registrants, nearly 2,000 proposals submitted, and now only 8 remain, vying for a single $100 million grant to be awarded by the MacArthur Foundation for the best idea and plan to help solve one of the world's most urgent social problems. Hear each of the 8 semifinalists of the 100 and Change competition on the Business of Giving and decide for yourself who deserves to be awarded the $100 million prize.
As regular listeners of the show know, we've had had the distinct pleasure of covering the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change competition over the past year or so, including getting to hear from each of the 8 semifinalists. The winner was announced in December, and I thought it'd be worth recapping this extraordinary enterprise, starting with the woman who oversaw the whole thing. Cecilia Conrad, the Managing Director of the MacArthur Foundation. Good evening, Cecilia, and welcome back to the show.
Good evening, and it's wonderful to be back. Thank you.
For those tuning in for the first time, just give us a brief overview of 100 and Change.
So 100 and Change is a MacArthur initiative to identify a problem and solution that $100 million could help either solve or take a big slice of or unlock the resources required to solve it. And we did this in an unusual way. We didn't define the problem or the domain. We issued an open call to the world and asked, tell us what $100 million might do. We opened that call in June of 2016. The submissions came in September, October of 2016. And then just recently, we announced the recipient of the $100 million grant.
Who was?
Sesame Workshop and the International Rescue Committee, who will be using the $100 million for an early childhood intervention program for children in the Syrian refugee region.
Great stuff. Well, as 100 and Change unfolded over the last year or two, were you surprised by anything?
First, I was surprised by the number of submissions we received. We received over 1,900 submissions from around the world on an array of topics and areas, some of them things I had no idea were major social problems or issues, some with solutions that were quite innovative. There was an amazing range of those projects. And so the first surprise was to recognize that we had a public resource, this huge database of solutions. And it's really inspiring to look through those.
It certainly is exceptional.
And we have those available. The Foundation Center has a special site that is a solutions bank from the MacArthur 100 and Change project. So we're hoping that people who are interested in what the ideas are will go and take a look and browse through those projects. That was the first surprise. The second surprise was the way in which the project, just the call for proposals, had an impact beyond the projects that ultimately became semifinalist and then finalist or even the recipient of the grant. We heard from organizations that it gave them an opportunity to think big in a way that they had never thought big before. And we're trying to collect all these sort of what I'll call externalities, little effects that have happened in organizations. So that was a surprise. And then the most recent wonderful surprise was the fact that our board found it so impossible to make a choice that they concluded that they needed to support all 4 of our finalists. So in addition to the single $100 million grant, they made grants of $15 million to each of the other 3 semifinalists.
Were you surprised by that?
Yes, I was. I was thrilled because it was such an expression of, first of all, the board's strong belief in those projects. And I think that was important in communicating to the world, but in particular to other funders, that these are projects worthy of support.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to see some activity that's emerging because of that initial, it's too big to be called a seed grant. I've been calling it a nest egg because of that nest egg investment that MacArthur has made.
Yeah, that was a absolutely wonderful gesture on the part of your board. I'll tell you what my surprise was that the 8 competitors, the semifinalists, became such good colleagues. I've never seen more goodwill between 8 people vying for the same prize in my entire life. And it just was a very warm experience to see how they cared about each other and how they supported each other. All fiercely competitive, mind you, but it wasn't what you thought it was going to be. They really liked one another.
That's true. And one of the things that happened with the 8 semifinalists is that we put some investment in capacity building for all 8. But that process also involved them working together.
Mm-hmm.
We had a workshop where they spent 3 or 4 days looking at each other's projects, giving each other feedback, making suggestions about potential sources of funding from their own networks, an amazingly generous group of people who all feel passionate about their projects and also came to recognize that they all shared this passion, particularly for vulnerable children.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're undertaking a thorough and comprehensive evaluation of this whole thing. What are going to be some of the things that you'll be looking at?
We'll be looking at sort of every little piece of the competition, from the way we designed it, to the criteria, to our judging process, to make sure that it was as efficient as it could be, to make sure it was as fair and transparent as it could be. One of the questions I'm particularly interested in is taking a look at where we received submissions and where we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Are there spaces that we didn't reach, people who didn't know about the competition who might have had really exciting projects to submit? Are there aspects of our criteria, of our rubric, of our judging process that may have made it more difficult for some fields versus others, and to investigate that more thoroughly so that we understand what any unintended consequences of our prize design might have been?
I recall when you were first on the show, we discussed prize philanthropy, its tremendous benefits as well as its limitations. Has your thinking changed any about prize philanthropy, its roles and possibilities, having lived through 100 and change?
No, I wouldn't say that my views have changed. I've seen play out some of the concerns about prize philanthropy. We are, as part of our review, trying to pay particular attention to the cost burden imposed on participants.
Mm-hmm.
Did we provide enough value to make that cost burden worthwhile? So we've been investigating that, and that's one of the things that we know is a challenge with prize philanthropy, that it does impose a burden on the participants. I think some of the benefits of prize philanthropy we've also seen played out in terms of stimulating conversations, stimulating thinking, stimulating collaborations. And so I think that part we've also seen played out. And certainly for the foundation, the projects that became our 8 semifinalists and our 4 finalists were not areas of work that would have been on our radar otherwise. So I think it did serve the purpose of expanding, getting us beyond our existing network.
Well, finally, Cecilia, will the MacArthur Foundation do this again? And if so, even at this early stage of reflection, anything you might do a little bit differently?
Well, yes, we do intend on having another version of 100 and change. And towards the second half of the year, we'll try and announce more specifics. One of the things that we want to do a little differently is to give a slightly longer launch pad from when we announce the competition to when the submissions are due, to give organizations a bit more time to think about what they want to submit, to reflect, to put together partnerships and collaborations than they had in that first iteration. We will, as I said earlier, be looking at every aspect of the competition. I'm not anticipating major changes, mm-hmm. but there will be tweaks.
Well, Cecilia Conrad, the Managing Director of the MacArthur Foundation, thanks for taking a few minutes to be with us this evening. And I want to thank you for allowing the Business of Giving to be part of this whole thing. I know firsthand that our audience really enjoyed and got a lot out of it. And joining me now on the phone is Bev Postma, the Chief Executive Officer of Harvest Plus, one of the 4 finalists of the 100 and Change competition. Good evening, Bev, and welcome back to the show.
Good evening, Denver. It's great to be back.
For those who may be tuning in for the first time, tell our listeners about the project you submitted.
Wow, it feels like a long time ago now, but just over a year ago, we submitted an application to transform nutrition in Africa using the power of agriculture. So our proposal was that we would hope to reach 100 million people in Africa with more nutritious crops. And we'll do that by breeding the nutrition back into staple food crops that many rural families are relying on. Mm-hmm. And the name of the project was Scaling Up Biofortification in Africa.
Having been a part of this competition, Bev, share some of your reflections, maybe some of the benefits that came as a result, as well as some of the challenges the organization experienced.
Well, the benefits, I must say, are too numerous to list. First of all, the benefit is that we came away with $15 million as the, from the MacArthur Foundation, which was just unbelievable. We entered a competition to win $100 million as a winner-takes-all competition. And we were just blown away by the generosity of the MacArthur Foundation when they announced that they would not only be awarding $100 million, a fantastic and very worthy winner in the IRC and Sesame Street, but also awarding $15 million to each of the other three finalists.
How did you react to that news? I mean, it was a complete surprise, I know.
Yeah, I mean, nobody expected it. I hear even the staff in the MacArthur Foundation weren't aware of this. So, I mean, of course, we focused for over a year on bringing in $100 million. So, of course, there was a little bit of initial disappointment that we didn't make it to the number one spot. But then, of course, the news sunk in that we were taking home $15 million that we can spend immediately in Africa to scale up our program. So it's been a real mood of celebration.
How do you plan on using it, leveraging it to support and scale up those programs and your life-changing work?
Well, the great news is that we're ready to go. We've moved well beyond the pilot stages in six countries in Africa. We have a very proven model of getting these crops into the hands of farming families. So we're both going to expand the work in our initial six countries where we've had strong operational support from many partners and governments for many years. But the great news is it means we can expand into three or four new countries this year. And we're working with the MacArthur Foundation to determine exactly which those countries are and to get that action on the ground as soon as possible.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Bev, for being with us and for the remarkable work that Harvest Plus does.
Thank you so much.
And with us now is Sherry Weston, the Executive Vice President of Global Impact and Philanthropy of Sesame Workshop, and along with the International Rescue Committee, are the winners of the $100 million award from the MacArthur Foundation. Congratulations, Sherry!
Thank you so much. It's amazing.
It certainly is. Just review for our listeners, what was your winning submission?
Well, our submission was a proposal to bring early education to refugee children in the Syrian response region, which is Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. And what this allows us to do with a grant of this size is to create the largest early childhood intervention in the history of humanitarian response. And we will be reaching over 9 million children through Sesame Street, local Sesame adaptation to meet the needs of those children through television, through mobile. But equally important, with our partners, the International Rescue Committee, we'll be able to reach 1.5 million of the most vulnerable children with direct services. And by that, I mean home visitations, learning centers, all empowered with Sesame content that will be delivered directly to caregivers and children. And that really does help to build resiliency, to help them overcome much of the trauma that they've experienced, and to give their parents and caregivers tools and strategies to help those young children.
That is absolutely incredible. What was it like when you received the news that your organization and IRC were the winners of $100 million? I mean, how did you react?
Well, I will never forget it because we knew we were going to receive a call from MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand there were four incredible finalists and all such incredible work and worthy. And at that point, I really didn't expect that we would be the final. But we knew we would receive a call during a certain window. And as that window started, you know, was sort of closing, I was told, okay, MacArthur's on the line. So I asked everyone to stay outside of my office. I did not want them all in around me. So I could see them outside my office, like more and more people gathering because I have a glass door and glass wall. So I got the call, and it was from Cecilia and her staff. And she said, you know, Sherry, we have a room full of people here. And I sort of thought for a minute, well, gosh, if we lost, it seems odd to have a room full of people. Like, maybe this is a good sign. But she first told us that that the board was so impressed with all of the finalists that they had decided to give $15 million to each of the 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really thought that meant that we were receiving $15 million. And I said to her, that is so incredible. You know, I think that is so wise of the board and so impressive because all of these organizations are doing such amazing work. And I meant that. And then she said, well, there's more.
Mm-hmm.
And she explained that they were going to give a planning grant to all 8 of the semifinalists because there were another 4 amazing groups before we got to 4.
That's
and
right.
We had gotten to know one another through the process. And so I said, wow, I think that is so incredible because none of us, you know, we had all put a lot of time and resources into this process. And then she saved the best for last and said, and the board has decided that Sesame and IRC will receive the $100 million. And I think I burst into tears.
Oh,
my,
wow.
All the people outside my office were trying to read the tea leaves. Like, wait, it looks like she's crying.
Yes.
Of course, I wouldn't have cried if they told us
right.
we didn't win. But
happy tears or sad tears? What kind of tears? Can you tell?
Tears. Happy tears. And then the funniest part is Cecilia said, when your staff find out, and I said, well, they'll hear in about a minute because they're all standing at my door. And she said, well, do us a favor and videotape when you tell them. So I thought, well, how am I going to do that? So I picked up my phone and texted my assistant and said, they want you to videotape when I tell the news, share the news. And I could hear my assistant through the door saying, oh, she's texting someone, because they're all watching me, you know,
uh-huh.
and I have my back to them. And I turned and pointed to her so she'd know it was her. And she goes, oh, she's texting me. So she holds up her phone and reads aloud, they want someone to tape me telling you. And when she said that, everyone, you know, burst into cheers because it was clear that what that meant. And then I turned and walked out. And I will never forget that moment.
Oh.
It was just it's so exciting.
Well,
and then I had
well,
the, and then I had the great privilege of calling David Miliband,
mm-hmm.
our partners, to tell him that, in fact, we had been chosen. So it was a great day.
Yeah, I bet it was. Well, thank you for sharing that. Finally, Sharon, you are embarking upon the largest childhood intervention in the history of humanitarian response. Where are you starting, and how are you going to measure your progress along the way?
Well, it is a huge endeavor, but one that we are so grateful for the opportunity, because if it weren't for sort of the audacious philanthropy and the bold vision for MacArthur to do this, we wouldn't have been able to plan what one would do with that amount of resources over 5 years. So through the MacArthur process, which was 18 months start to finish, we were able to develop strategies, timelines, budgets, measurements of success. And so we're in really pretty good shape in terms of understanding what we need to do. And now we begin. The grant started officially on February 1.
Mm-hmm.
The first step is we are building the team because it does require additional staff and resources both on the IRC side and Sesame side. We have a lot of the programs, so because we had already been working together in a model and a pilot, we are already on the ground in the region testing content. But of course, we didn't have the funding to create all new. So this allows us to continue the research, begin the process of creating all new content that will be completely local in Arabic and Iraqi Kurdish, and begin the training of the thousands of home visitors and facilitators who will help us in the direct interventions. And how will we measure success? Again, we have a timeline. We know at which point throughout the 5 years we're able to bring which resources to bear and launch the new programming, et cetera. But research is such a critical component of what we're doing, not only for us to be able to measure needs, but also to measure how it's going and to iterate so that we're constantly learning from our research, and we want to share that with the world. So all along the way, we will be measuring our progress, measuring our reach, measuring our impact, and again sharing that because we want this to be a catalyst for others in humanitarian response, not just for the children in this region.
Fantastic. Well, it's a big job, and I can't think of anything more important. Thanks so much, Sherry, and I hope you'll keep us posted on the progress and challenges of all this in the month and years ahead.
Well, it's a huge opportunity, and we know we can change the lives of so many children, and we're just so grateful.
Thanks a lot, Sherry.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change when she found Year Up. Like many in her community, she was smart and talented, but didn't have the same opportunities as others. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and experience, entering the healthcare IT field upon graduation. Year Up is a transformative opportunity for motivated young adults and companies looking for talent. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
Critical to a healthy democracy is an engaged and informed citizenry. And for most of us listening, that all began back in civics class. But today, when 77% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 34 can't name one U.S. senator representing their state, it may be time to reimagine civics class, which is precisely what Generation Citizen has done. And it's a pleasure to have with us their co-founder and CEO, Scott Warren. Good evening, Scott, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Great to be here. Excited to talk about it.
Your father was with the State Department, so you spent most of your childhood living overseas in Latin America and Africa. So it's quite ironic that you have started an organization that teaches civics in U.S. schools, a class that you never really attended yourself.
That's true.
What was your impetus for starting Generation Citizen?
Yeah, no, that's all very true. So I grew up in San Diego, and when I was 8 years old, my dad, who is a criminal defense attorney, had the definition of a midlife crisis and decided to join the State Department and move abroad. And so we spent 8 to 18 living in Latin America, East Africa. And after I got over the shell-shocked fact of leaving San Diego, I was able to have a lot of experiences where I recognized the power of democracy. I saw the first truly democratic elections in Kenya in 2002, which actually worked. They're having a lot of problems with democracies there right now. I saw a coup in Ecuador where I graduated from high school in 2005. And had all these experiences really realizing the power of individuals coming together to make a collective difference, but how fragile democracy could be too. So my parents were living in Zimbabwe when I was in college at Brown, and I was able to meet opposition activists there that were putting their lives on the line for democracy and for a country that would actually respect their opinions. And so I think for me, coming back to this country and attending college here, I realized that young people really wanted to make a difference. This trope of young people being apathetic is totally misguided.
Yeah.
But they didn't see government and politics as the way to do so. And I had grown up seeing all these people so excited to participate, seeing democracy as the lifeblood of a country. And so that disconnect between that excitement and energy that I had seen abroad and somewhat of the stasis that I saw here was one of the reasons that inspired me to think about how do we really think about reinvigorating our democracy. And I do think it begins with our young people.
Yeah, I agree. Well, civics class used to be very central to our curriculum. I remember when I used to come home with my report card, it was every bit as important as math or English, but less and less so in recent years. What are some of the things that contributed to this marginalization?
I think it's a few things. There's some folks, point to the Sputnik moment, and the moment that Sputnik was launched, and all of a sudden we engaged in the space war with the Soviets, and science and math and what now is called STEM was emphasized throughout the curriculum. And as part of that, I think we got worried that we were falling behind the rest of the world in science skills, and also that we weren't preparing young people for the new economy and an emerging economy. And so civics got seen as a nice to have. We need to ensure that young people know what it means to compete in a new and emerging marketplace, and teaching them how to participate in our democracy really isn't as important. I do think that some of it actually has to pertain to we live in, what may have been called an emerged democracy, something that was a little bit more established. And I think we just didn't see it as important to educate young people to participate in it. And in our education system at large, we've seen a little bit more of a focus on standardized testing, test scores, and civics is seen as a soft skill that gets thrown to the side. And so it's just not something that schools have been prioritizing. It really is, if students learn math, science, English, three languages, get PE, health class, and maybe we can talk about civics. It's seen as the last priority.
Well, how proficient are, let's say, eighth graders in civics? What do they know and what do they not know?
So one of the interesting things is the National Assessment of Education Progress, the NAEP test, actually shows that eighth graders test worse on civics and history than any other subject. So it's really dire. And I think you can point to specific facts, like the fact that only a third of people in this country can name all three branches of government, and a third can't name any at all. More than 75% of young people can't name one of their U.S. senators. There's a lot of facts, and then there's the belief part of it. And I think one of the most dire stats right now is that you have about a quarter of young people, and this is much more than in prior times, but a quarter of young people actually believe that living in a democracy is a bad thing and not something that we should aspire to. And so,
only 33% of them think it's an essential thing.
Right. And so you can't actually live in a surviving democracy if people actually don't believe that it's important. So I think sometimes we think a lot about the facts, but it's the motivations and the skill sets and the beliefs in democracy that are really really important too, and things that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that democracies are under assault across the globe.
Yeah.
It's just not in the United States. It's countries
right.
all over the place. You see a lot of these emerging countries now looking to the Chinese model
right.
as maybe something that they should consider emulating. And I've heard other people say that democracies were created when information was scarce
mm-hmm.
and that they're just not as effective when there's an abundance of information. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of times I talk about Kenya as this story that inspired me. And just in the past few weeks, you've seen a lot of challenges there where you had the opposition candidate actually take the people's oath of office and the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, basically shut down the TV stations for, 5 days.
Yep.
I think to the China example, one thing you're seeing is with the global economic downturn, I think people are looking to different forms of government that can actually provide for them and their families. The form of government becomes less important than who's putting food on the table. And you have seen China and some of the countries in East Asia that have promised and delivered on beneficial economic results without having full democracies. I don't think that's sustainable. I think on the aggregate, if you look across the world, countries that have more participation have less income inequality. And I also think that the notion that democracies are reliant on people not having a ton of information doesn't give people enough credit. And I think that we're in an ecosystem now where there's a ton of challenges, right? And I think that that's part of the problem when you talk about democracy is, yes, there is a problem that we're not educating people to know what it means to participate, but we're also not educating them on the values and behaviors that are associated with becoming part of a democracy as well. So how do you talk to people that don't agree with you? How do we get past this polarization? I think all of that starts in our schools. And so thinking about teaching democracy is less about this civics knowledge piece, but more about this all-encompassing what does it mean to be an effective citizen is something that I think is important too.
Well, let's turn our attention to that. The program you bring to schools is something that you call Action Civics.
Mm-hmm.
Describe for us how it works.
So part of the things that I think we thought about in starting Generation Citizen is that there were two problems. One is that civics wasn't taught to the extent that it used to be, as you said. And the other is that when it is taught, it's seen as the most boring class in school. Here are the three branches of government. Here's how a bill becomes a law. Go take a test. And the most effective way to learn something is through doing it. You learn science by actually engaging in science experiments. You
right.
learn STEM by doing robotics and actually creating robots. And
experiential
so,
learning.
Exactly. And so Action Civics, I mean, we put the action in front of civics and everything changes, but Action Civics is really about learning civics by doing civics.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think we actually do is create a real world lab for civic engagement. So our students in middle and high schools across the country choose very local issues that they care about. That's another thing that I think has been missing from our political realm is the importance of local activism. They'll choose local issues like teen jobs, violence in their communities, public transit comes up a lot in New York, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
And then they take real action. They meet with city council members, they meet with state legislators, they mobilize their fellow students, and they take action. And through that process of actually taking action, especially at the local level, they're actually learning how the process works and learning how they can use their voices to make a difference in it.
So the class picks a single issue for
mm-hmm.
that year and then works on it all year to see if they can effectuate that change.
Exactly. And so the process of choosing an issue is actually challenging in its own right, because you have some students that say, we really want to focus on the fact that, the MTA prices have gone through the roof, and some folks that want to focus on immigration or want to focus on police community relations. And they actually have to, through a consensus building process, come to one issue. And again, I think that's a really important part of the democratic process is realizing you can't all get what you want. You
yeah.
have to figure out how to compromise and select one issue. But they select one issue as a class. They figure out what's the root cause of that problem. How can we actually take some sort of real action? And so, that looks like students in the Bronx that look at gentrification and affordable housing, and then as a root cause, find a city council bill that would provide tax incentives to landowners that provide more affordable housing. These are 11th graders working on a deep public problem in that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Another example that I like to throw out is that we had a class in Brooklyn that looked at cafeteria food, because everybody looks at cafeteria food, right? So I think that the normal instinct is to say, we want better cafeteria food. Let's march for better cafeteria food. They looked at the root cause and determined that just like restaurants throughout the city actually get a sanitation score for how clean their restaurant is, so do school cafeterias.
Mm-hmm.
Every school cafeteria gets a grade, but they're not required to be public.
Ah.
So they actually worked on an assembly bill law that would require schools throughout the state to make their sanitation grades public and got that law passed.
That is very cool.
So through that process, they actually understand how the legislature works mm-hmm. and how they can focus on more systemic change rather than just focusing on a specific problem in their
school. And what is the theory of change that you're bringing to this work?
So I think what we fundamentally believe is that our democracy will be stronger if we have more people participate in it. And in order to ensure that we have a strengthened democracy with more robust participation, we need to ensure that we're teaching young people before they actually turn voting age, right? I think that that's a challenge that we often see in democracy work, is that seemingly we only treat people as participants in a democracy once they turn 18. So I sometimes see it as, you know, when you turn 16, you can get your driver's license, but you don't wake up at 16 with your driver's license on your doorstep.
Get behind a Tesla.
Yeah. You have to get a permit. You have to take lessons. You practice. So I really see what we're doing as a driver's education for our democracy. How can we train young people before they actually take the reins?
That's a great metaphor. And I think that's what's really distinctive about this is that this is an in-school class.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an extracurricular activity or a club. And I guess that's really central to your mission in terms of this broad participation.
Yeah, we see this as just as important as math class or science class or English class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sets us apart. There's a lot of great after-school extracurricular activities. But if we really want to ensure our mission is that every student in this country receives an effective action civics education, if we really want to do that, we need to figure out how does this become embedded in education systems across the country. And a more macro question is how can we ensure – we often talk about the fact that, you know, the reason that public schools in this country were created was to create, engage, and active citizens. The reason public schools exist are to preserve our democracy. But what does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, we've definitely gotten away from the civic mission of schools. And so I think one thing that we're thinking about is not only how do we get action civics in schools, but how do we get schools writ large to recognize their obligation to create cultures that embody the democratic spirit that we want to see throughout our country. Oftentimes, I think some of the most undemocratic institutions in America are public schools. They're very autocratic. And so our curriculum is very student-centered. They choose the issues that they care about. They choose how they take action. It's really up to them. And that's something that I think is germane to effective education writ large.
Have you seen an increase in the interest around action civics since the 2016 presidential campaign? We have the Women's March. I mean, are young people sort of getting more and more engaged around these issues the last 24 months?
Yeah. I started Generation Citizen in 2008, 2009, and I joke with people that for the first 4, 5, 6 years of starting, I'd tell people, oh, you know, we're all about educating young people to be active citizens. They're getting civics back in the classroom, and eyes would glaze over. You know, who else can I talk to? And now people say, oh, my God, that's so important.
Yeah.
How do we get civics everywhere? So there is more interest. We're strictly nonpartisan, and I think it would be a mistake to point to one election as causing a demise or decay in our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's been going on for a while.
Sure.
And so I think that the fact that there's more interest is undoubtedly a positive. And I guess the question for us is how do we maintain that interest? Our democracy is not going to get better, you know, through one election. It's going to get better through actually focusing on the foundations of our democracy. So I think there is more interest, and we have to figure out how to really sustain that.
Yeah, and one of the byproducts of what you do is that there's a lot of collaboration in this. And from what I remember from school, it's pretty individualistic. So getting groups to work together like this, which is going to be what they're going to be doing in the real business world when they get out, is really something special.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. A lot of times when I talk to students after they're done with Generation Citizen and ask what was different for you about this experience, they point to that exact fact, that their success was dependent on the success of a group. And I think in many ways, our education system has become very individualized. You think about standardized tests.
Yeah.
Students are judged based on how they do as individuals. If you think about a democracy, you know, e pluribus unum, where it's about the individual and how it works together as a collective. If schools don't reflect that, then our democracy won't either. So it's a very collaborative process. There's challenges when it's collaborative. We all remember in school whenever we did group projects, you know, I think we thought, oh, the one person takes the lead and everybody falls back. In this curriculum, you have different groups working on different aspects of the action. So you'll have one group that's responsible for getting in touch with the city council member. You have one group that's responsible for the social media campaign. You'll have one group that's responsible for doing research. They can't be successful unless they're all successful.
Good.
And I think that's something that's, you know, important for our democracy.
Yeah.
We're all better off when we're all better off.
Get those nodes working together.
Yeah.
You have a Generation Citizen Civics Day where students present the issues they have taken action on, to community members and elected officials. You've been to a whole bunch of us, of them. Share with us some of the things that you've witnessed on these days.
Yeah, it's always one of my favorite parts of the semester. And I always go up to students and ask, what did you think about Generation Citizen at the beginning and what do you think now? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of interesting because a lot of times at the beginning, and I think this is so reflective of what young people think, they, you know, said, oh, we thought this was going to be dumb. People came into class and thought and said, you're going to take action and make a difference on issues you care about. And their eyes would roll and they'd say, you know, that's not going to happen. And then at Civics Day, what happens is that they engage with public officials and community members from all over the city. We're in New York and Rhode Island and Boston and the Bay Area and Oklahoma and Texas, and I get to go to all of them. And it's just really inspiring to see how active and energetic these young people are to present on the issues they care about. So at this past New York City Civics Day, I remember talking to a group of young women, and their issue was figuring out, how do we work with the city to get more monuments built for African-American abolitionists? So we have a hot topic going on in the mm-hmm. city and across the country of, you know, are we taking down Confederate monuments? What are we doing about other monuments? What are we doing about the Christopher Columbus monument here? And they said, you know, that conversation can continue to happen, but, you know, we're African-American and we don't see, you know, any monuments across the city that represent us. And yeah. So they're actually working with the city, you know, to get that done. I went to Austin, and just the number of classes there that were focused on immigration. Because in Austin specifically, they've been sort of at war with the state, Austin trying to become a sanctuary city, the state of Texas pushing back. And you had students whose family members were deported, who felt they're at risk themselves. And so it's actually very sobering talking to, you know, 14 and 15 year olds that are dealing with issues that really affect them. And I think that's one of the most powerful parts of Action Civics, is that you're not dealing with the theoretical components of democracy, where I feel like so many of our arguments actually lie. But you're dealing with young people who, you know, are taking action on gun control because a fellow eighth grader was shot. I mean, these are issues that are so fundamental to who they are as individuals. And I think that's the power of democracy, taking action on issues that actually really affect us.
Yeah. And you have some dramatic results at the end of a school year. 72% have an increased knowledge about civics and a whole bunch of other things. You're still a relatively young organization. Have you any longitudinal data at all? Are you beginning to work on it to see whether the seeds that were planted through this class continue on?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We think about our success in terms of three main indicators: civic knowledge, so how much they know about the political process; civic motivation, so how much they actually want to participate mm-hmm. and feel like they can make a difference; and then civic skills, which I think are some of the most important work, as you were talking about: critical thinking, group work and collaboration, oral and written persuasive communication. So can they actually make an argument? So in from beginning of semester to end of semester, we've seen dramatic increases in those results. You know, what is going to be the devil in the details is, are our students voting at higher rates?
Yeah.
Are they leaders in their community? And qualitatively, we've seen that. We've seen some of our students run for office. We've seen our students continue to stay involved in this type of work. But that's going to be a priority going forward, is actually proving that this leads to increased voting rates, that this leads to the ability to work across boundaries. This leads to, you know, actually understanding who your public officials are, really at the local level too. I mean, if you look at, despite all the activism, if you look at the 2017 New York City mayoral, you had, you know, about 20% participation. I want to see our young people voting at really high rates in local elections, because I think that's really where they can have an impact.
Well, speaking of that, one of the things you've been advocating for is lowering the voting age to 16, at least for local elections. What's the case you make here, and how has the response been to it?
Yeah, so it's interesting. One of the things that we thought a lot about is, how can we ensure that we tell young people that your voice can actually matter, and it can matter now? And so a lot of times when we talk to people about lowering the voting age to 16, and we are talking exclusively about local elections, people say that's ridiculous. 16-year-olds don't know anything. But the argument is, 18 might not be a great age to start voting at. Young people are either in college or they're in the workforce and they're not thinking of voting. And you can actually show a downward trend. And we lowered the voting age to 18 in 1971 as a result largely of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And there's been a downward trend in voting since then amongst youth populations. And there's a whole host of reasons, but one might be that 18 is not a great age. And so what we're saying is, you know, if we can get young people to vote in local elections, while they're still at home, while they're still in school. And again, we're just talking local elections. It will help to create lifelong voters.
Yeah.
If you vote in your first election, you're statistically much more likely to vote in subsequent elections. And so you have three cities in Maryland, Tacoma Park, Hyattsville, and Greenbelt, that have lowered the voting age to 16. We have an active effort in Washington, D.C. And I will say in San Francisco in 2016, we had a voter referendum. About 3 months before the election, we did a poll, and 55% of people thought that there was no way we should lower the voting age. They were against it. 30% of people were for it. We engaged in a vigorous public education campaign, making the same points I just said. We lost by 2 points. 49% of people thought it was a good idea. We'll run it again in 2020 and expect to win. So this is something that I think it just needs to be talked about more.
Right.
We need innovative ideas on how to improve our democracy, how to encourage participation. And we think this is an innovative idea that countries across the world are doing. You know, you have countries in Scandinavia, countries in South America that are doing this, and they see, you know, increased measures of civics education and increased measures of local voting. So it's something that we're interested in continuing to talk about.
I know you have an ambitious revenue strategy and you're looking to diversify your funding streams. Tell us a little bit about your business model and the sources of support that make all this great work possible.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about fundraising since we started, and I'm learning more every day. When I got into this work, I had no idea how to do it. You don't get into this work because you want to fundraise. You get into
it because you don't.
You like the mission, and so you learn as you go along. So, you know, we do have a diverse funding stream. So we have about 40% of our funding from foundations, including some big institutional ones like the Ford Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation that are showing an increased interest in civics education. Our model, we have six offices across the country, like I said. So Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, San Francisco, Oklahoma, and Texas. So we're trying.
By the way, I say I like that Oklahoma and Texas. So often organizations like this stay on the coast, but you've really gone to the center of the country when you're going to Oklahoma.
Yeah, that was really intentional, and I will say that was a decision that we made in 2015. So it was before the election, but I think we really wanted to say if we're a national organization that cares about ensuring that every young person in this country can receive an effective action civics education, we can't just work on the coast. And so what we've done is in those sites, we work with those sites so that they become self-sustainable. And so that includes a lot of local fundraising. So they're working with local foundations and local individuals that are invested in that work. And then we also charge a fee to schools. We predominantly work with low-income schools, but if we're able to demonstrate that this is something that is a core priority for their school, they'll put some dollars into it. We've also been really beneficial and lucky. We receive $500,000 a year from the New York City Council. So the past speaker, Melissa Mark Viverito, made this a priority for the council. We hope to work with the new speaker, Corey Johnson, as well. But the city, through the speaker, said, you know, it's a priority for us that young people are becoming active and engaged citizens, and so we're going to invest in this work. And so we really see this public-private mix is something that we'll continue to do going forward, too.
Fantastic. Let me close with this, Scott. With so many young people, especially from low-income communities, frustrated, disillusioned, and cynical about government and politics, what is your source of optimism that we can successfully change that mindset?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And if you read the paper in the morning, it sometimes is tough to be optimistic. And I always think, you know, the bigger an organization gets, sometimes the less you actually engage with the constituency that you're working with. And so I really try to ensure that I'm actively listening and working and talking to the young people that we work with. And it's a little cliche, but what does give me optimism is when I talk to 14, 15, 16-year-olds that are not only passionate about making a change, but really conversant in the issues that affect their communities. And so I think so often on the national, we just get caught up in what the latest tweets say or what's the drama of politics of the day. And when you talk to young people, who are really facing substantive issues in their communities that don't necessarily pertain to the conversations that are happening on cable TV or in the Twitter sphere or on the front pages of the paper, but they're leading on these issues. And they're leading on these issues because they have experience in these issues. And I think that's what gives me hope, is that you are seeing a renewed spirit of activism.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a renewed spirit of activism on the local level. You're seeing young people recognize that active citizenship and politics is not a dirty word, but something that they can actually lead on. I guess the last thing I'll say is that whenever you've seen positive change in this country, it comes from young people. I mean, you can look from, you know, from the civil rights movement to the fight for marriage equality. Every movement is led by young people that don't see the world for what it is, but for what it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm incredibly lucky to work in a job where I get to every day work with young people that refuse to accept the current state of our politics and actively want to work for something better. And so I think channeling that idealism is something that we all need to do right now. And that's what we're trying to do at Generation Citizen.
And it is an incredible job. Well, Scott Warren, the CEO of Generation Citizen, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Tell us about your website. Is there a way for people to let you know that they would like you to come to their community? And how can they help support this work if they're so inclined?
Yeah, so our website is www.generationcitizen.org. We're actively engaged in a scaling strategy. Last year, we worked with 10,000 students. In 2019-2020, we want to be working with 30,000 students across the country. So we're looking for new communities to partner with. So you can just email us, info@generationcitizen.org, or my personal email, scott@generationcitizen.org, and we'd love to start a conversation.
Great. Thanks, Scott. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
A lot of fun.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And for this edition of Better Than Most, we'll be visiting the New York offices of Teach for America. They are committed to catalyzing leadership to realize the day when all children in this nation will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. Let's hear from some of the members of this passionate and dedicated team.
One of our core values was relentless pursuit, if you guys remember that one, and sense of possibility. And using those core values at that time, I was able to go back to school and start and lost 100 pounds. But it was also, it was what everybody else was doing at work. Seeing people working and being so committed to our mission on a general basis that I started to apply what I was seeing from everybody in the organization, the communal sense of let's get this done, let's get it on time, our kids need us. I started to see myself as being, I am one of those kids, and I started to just model what was being done by our staff here into my personal life to then create my own personal achievements. So to me, that's one of the things that really stood out, just that communal, let's get this done, our kids need us, and I think that we just drive from that.
I didn't have to deal with the bureaucracy of, you know, of being ill, because we had an incredible benefits team that just helped me every step of the way, made sure I was okay, and, you know, really saw me as a person, not just another employee that they have to help, you know. And they also had this amazing benefits where they'll, you know, they'll pay for, they'll give you your full pay for up to 8 weeks, so I could just focus on getting better. I didn't have to worry about paying my rent or paying my bills because the organization makes policies based on their people, you know. So that, for me, is one of the things that really stood out.
We have a level of trust and knowing that, like, we're doing this, we're having the hard conversations, not because, like, we want to make each other's lives miserable, but because, like, we have to say the hard things here so that we can go out and be a united front. And so I just feel like I'm in an environment where I'm not dinged for being direct. I'm not dinged for saying what's on my mind. I'm not dinged for just, you know, naming the thing that nobody wants to say, usually in other spaces. And I know that at the end of the day, like, it's always made me better. It's made me more confident. It's made me, like, it's propelled my own leadership, and it's really helped us at Teach for America, I think, accomplish all that we have.
I guess what I want to focus in on is that moving through last year, I joined the Core Values Committee. And that for me was an opportunity for, like, our organization, we looked at our core values and decided to revamp them. And I couldn't quite imagine, like, that I would be chosen to be a part of a committee like that to get that work done, because we were people from all over our community that came together to do that work with Elisa, our CEO, VPs and managers, people of all levels, and, like, little 312 Jackie that also got to be a part of that. And I think, I think that experience changed my life, because I saw how important, like, not only my experience was as my as just who I am, but like that was also just as important as Elisa's opinion about the core values, and like that we were all able to have these debates and wrestle for hours and hours and hours about single words that went into the core values. I mean, it was a crazy experience, and I think for me it was like just a reminder that like a Teach for America, all of us matter.
And it was hard for me I was not expecting that. I wasn't expecting my team to be so insistent about me just going to be with my family and taking over my entire responsibility and delivering the results at a really high level themselves. And so I think that balance of caring about people, but also doing the work really well because we care about the mission, is something that really just excites me about working at Teach for America.
Another thing that I wanted to mention is management. When I came in, I told my boss, he asked me a whole bunch of questions that were not related to my job. And he found out I love words and I love to write. So he had me write a poem for him for our check-in that I gave to him every single week. And a lot of times I would not do the poem and he'll be like, you got to spit one out right now. And I would have to improvise a poem for him. And that really just provided me with the essence to want to learn more and to educate myself. And now I'm in a creative writing program. And my boss also has taken all of my interests and figure out a way for them to become my job.
How, you know, it shaped the way I view the world and how I viewed people around me. And because of that, you know, I feel like not only am I a better person, I'm better at my job because I don't just accept things as they are now. I question it, and it's given me the confidence to question it out loud. And because I've discovered over the 8 years here that not only will Teach for America leaders be okay with me asking it, but encourage me to ask it, even if it's, you know, reflecting something that may not be so pretty.
And that's something that I love about Teach for America. It's like, it is the learning, the fact that we are all constantly striving to learn how to do better, whether that's a system inside of Teach for America or just for ourselves personally.
My goal is to stay with Teach for America for as long as I potentially can. I really do want to become a chief of staff. And so my manager heard that. We created a really personalized and customized development plan to really take on a lot of those responsibilities and to really grow me in a lot of those areas. And I was also given the opportunity to attend the People, Culture, and Diversity Conference, which is going to happen in Denver. And I know a lot of other chiefs of staff will be there.
And we know that in order to have a diverse pool of applicants to make the right hiring decisions, it actually requires a much more expansive process. And so our team, over the past 3-4 years, has completely overhauled the way that we approach hiring. And as a hiring manager myself, I now feel equipped from the leadership of our team make smart decisions and have a really strong and diverse pool of candidates that reflect the background of our students, that reflect our city. And a few specific evolutions that I've been excited about on this front, we've moved from having like a single hiring manager to having hiring teams make those decisions together collaboratively. We've also introduced competency-based numeric rubrics to make sure that we're making fair decisions on hiring. We've moved to more expansive reference checks. And every manager in our region has undergone several rounds of culturally competent hiring manager training. And I just think that hiring is one area where I have seen TFA make a commitment to improving and changing over time in a positive way.
So we have like a coaching culture, and then some regions and teams even, I think, go a little bit deeper into different types of coaching. And so one of my coach in particular, she works with me really as like I'm her client and she's my coach. And that's our relationship, where she's not managing me. She's not, you know, telling me I need to see this deliverable. She's really looking to see what is it that I need. I also coach people. So I manage people, but I also coach people. And when I coach people, I say, I'm coaching you at the place where you need to be. I actually stand in your greatness. And so whatever it is that you need is what I'm going to develop and what you can identify.
When I think about the magic, or when I think about Teach America, I actually think there's something pretty magical about it. Because although we're in different regions, we all care about like the same thing. And we're all working towards like the same end, and we're not in one building. And for me, there's something magical about that. And when I think about our work as staff members to do very specific things for our jobs, it actually doesn't feel like it's just staff doing them. We have over 50,000 alumni who've completed our program, and they feel as much a part of the team as any staff member.
I'll go back to the point about staff recognition, and I think TFA does a really beautiful job of figuring out people's learning and working styles and figuring out how in that people like to be recognized. A lot of folks enjoy more public recognition, while some other individuals like more private recognition. When your year of service comes up, it is a very big deal. It, you know, talks about your commitment to the organization and also shows that your organization really values you and shouts you out personally. And this past Wednesday was her year of service, and so I asked each staff member to contribute 1 to 3 sentences as to what impact she's had on the team and what impact she has had in our entire region, and people just contributed the most beautiful, thoughtful things. I came in with flowers for her, I know her favorite snack, and I think that's just another way that we really affirm and show people that we appreciate them in a lot of different ways.
I want to thank Jackie McCarthy, Deepa Purohit, and Lindsay Ferguson for organizing my visit, and to those who took part in this segment, John Valdez, Minerva Inigo, Taina Perez, Jackie Yonker, Alana Valinsky, Joseph Malone, and Levi Moog. To hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and the Teach for America offices, they're all there waiting for you at denver-frederick.com. And that is this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. Have yourself a great week, and I hope you'll be back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.